Hello, everybody, Marathon, and this is On The Gadget Talk for Wednesday, 29th of June, 2022. In today's episode, Sony launches a new gaming monitor designed for PC and the PlayStation 5. Plus, we got more details about the Nothing Phone 1, and you definitely want to stick around to hear about that. And finally, at the end, we'll briefly talk about Hyundai's newest EV. Well, they kind of showed off the design of it, basically. We knew it was coming. I mean, it was long awaited. The IONIQ 6, obviously, that's towards the end. So yeah, it's going to be a pretty interesting episode. One thing, one interesting thing to note is that it's been 15 years since the first iPhone went on sale, because it went on sale on June 29th, 2007. That's a very long time ago. I was very young when the first iPhone came out, and it's a device that has changed Apple and the world at large. Pretty interesting fact. But yeah, anyways, let's just get rolling, shall we? First up, Sony. They released a product that we definitely didn't expect was coming, and you definitely didn't expect them to make, and that is a gaming monitor. So yesterday, Sony showed off the InZone M9. So InZone is like their new brand that they've created, essentially to create PC gaming gear. Because PC gaming is all the rage, PCMR for life, okay? PC Master Race is winning, making moves. Sony has created a gaming monitor. And as I said, it's the very first monitor of its kind. The thing is, Sony is well known for displays, and they're obviously well known for making professional monitor displays for video editors and all those kind of people, for remastering and post-production. And obviously everyone knows Sony being a TV brand, and obviously known for its audio gear, for its TV gear. It's best in class, pretty much. Once you look past Samsung and LG, there's Sony, basically. So it's well-renowned, it's world-renowned for its displays. And it's really good quality. And everyone knows the Trinitons and the Bravias. It's iconic. But now they have a new brand. And as I said, it's quite rare for the Japanese giant to create a new product line. But when they do it, we gotta pay attention. Because as I said, it's not that often you see Sony make a completely new line of products catering to a new consumer base. They've been getting into things like, for example, satellite communications and electric cars. Obviously, that latter one is a joint venture with Honda. But they're getting ambitious, and I think it's good to see with Sony. But anyways, what do we have here? So what we have here is the InZone M9, and this is a high-resolution gaming monitor. Now, to the untrained eye, it kind of looks like a PS5 display. Now, for those who remember and have very strong memory, will remember that Sony made a PlayStation 3D display that worked with the PS3 and can display games in 3D. And that kind of worked. Some people bought it. It was popular. But obviously, we haven't seen such a display since. So one can say that the InZone M9 is a spiritual successor to the PlayStation 3D display, if you know that display, because that came for the PS3, pretty much. This one basically is designed for both a gaming PC and the PlayStation 5. In fact, the base of the monitor has the design language from the PS5. So you could basically say this is the professional display for the PS5, technically, a high-resolution full HDR display. So it has display HDR 600, so it could display up to 600 nits of HDR goodness. Full array local dimming, 144 hertz refresh rate, IPS, and 1 millisecond gray-to-gray response time. So pretty impressive, if you ask me. And again, packs a punch when you look at it. And you get 95% DCI P3 coverage. So this is a pretty interesting product from Sony. Again, something we didn't expect, completely out of the blue in a way. This is a 27-inch 4K monitor. So you get 4K resolution and 600-nit HDR. And again, deep blacks and great highlights, which is what we'd want. As I said, this is the monitor to get if you have a PS5. You want to take full advantage of the PS5's immense performance and, again, picture quality. and visual fidelity, you can get this. Obviously, there is the Bravia OLEDs. Those obviously are the best TVs to get, the best displays, you can say, you can get for the PS5. But now you have a gaming monitor. And this is roughly 20... Let me reiterate this again. This is 27-inch. So this is basically a perfect size for a monitor instead of getting a 40, 50-inch TV on your gaming desk to play, I don't know, Horizon Zero Dawn or God of War on your computer. Now, they've designed this monitor, as I said, for the PS5 and for gaming PCs. Now, I can come to guess that they originally designed these accessories, these monitors and also gaming headsets for the PlayStation consoles, but let's face it, the PS5 has not been regularly available in stock. There's been a shortage of PS5s, and it cost a lot of money to get one because, again, in such high demand. So they've also designed these monitors to work with PCs, and they've emphasized the gaming PC element, which I think is important. This is obviously a change of direction from Sony, where they previously emphasized PlayStation, but now they're also making a point about PC gaming, which is, again, a massive segment that you cannot really ignore, and you cannot really skip, because, again, it's a massive segment. There's a big chunk of the world that basically buys a computer and then either does productivity tasks or obviously plays games or one of the two. But again, it's pretty interesting in a way. And again, the design of it makes it seem like a PS5 display, even though it isn't. But interestingly enough, the M9 has automatic KVM. Now, if you are a PC user, or again, if you have one of those workstation monitors, you will know KVM is this feature where there's a USB hub right in the monitor, and you can connect, if I remember correctly, you can connect a Type-B cable to your computer, to your laptop and PC, and vice versa. And the idea is you could switch between, and if you connect anything to the monitor, either computer can access it with a quick switch, basically. So that's what KVM means. And it's a big help, because if you have 3-4 computers at once, and you can only need one set of peripherals, which is, again, a pretty big deal, interestingly enough. You have FPS game picture mode, so that's pretty interesting. And again, there is HDR here, which is pretty nice to have in a way. Now, this monitor will start in the US from $900. Now, that's a lot of money for a gaming monitor in a way. So that's pretty interesting nonetheless. Now, what if you don't want a 4K 27-inch monitor, and you might as well get another? You can probably get competing options for much less, or obviously a full-blown 4K TV. There's the InZone M3 on the flip side. The M3 is a full HD 240Hz monitor, same size, but as I said, you have full HD only and 240Hz response rate, and again, you get variable refresh rate in HDMI 2.1, so that's good for your PS5, generally speaking. That's pretty cool. And you have 400 nits HDR, display HDR 400, so that'll give you HDR up to 400 nits of brightness, and 99% of sRGB color range. That's the thing, it's a completely different panel in a way, so that's pretty interesting nonetheless. And again, it's the same panel, IPS, but again, different resolution. I watched a video about yesterday, the monitor. The M3 would probably be cheaper than the M9, around $400 to $500. So it's, again, it's a premium gaming monitor. If you don't want the crispy resolution, the crispy 4K, but you want HDR, but as you want higher refresh rate, you have that option, and it's there. And you could save like $300 to $400 in a way, so that's pretty interesting. Now, both monitors support NVIDIA G-Sync, so that's something to keep in mind. And again, variable refresh rate. Again, that's G-Sync is good for your gaming PCs, so that's pretty cool. If you live in Europe, it'll cost, the M9 from Sony will cost about 1,100 euros, give or take. And you should expect to see the M9 in stores this summer. And the M3, which is the full HD high refresh rate monitor, will be available later in the year. And again, judging from US pricing, it'll be $400 to $500 cheaper, roughly, give or take. So that's pretty interesting nonetheless. On the flip side, interestingly enough, they also showed off some new gaming headsets, which are, again, similar to the PlayStation headsets that they've been selling for a long, long time. And they kind of look like the official PS5 headset, in a way, interestingly. So that's pretty cool. So you have an H3, H7, and H9. The H3 is the cheapest. It's $100. It's a wired headset. You have low frequency sound reproduction for powerful bass, according to the press release here. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And on top of that, you have 360-degree spatial sound. Okay, I was meant to say spatial audio, spatial sound. Anyways, so all three headsets basically give you precise target detection, basically able to hear the footsteps of someone of your targets. So, you know, so that's pretty cool. But generally, the basic difference is that the H3 is basically the cheapest wired sort of headset at $100. And then the H7, on the other hand, gives you 40 hours of battery life. And again, you have acoustic, you have, and again, just a solid all-rounder at $200 to $250, €230, according to this press release. And then the H9 is the high-end variant with 32 hours of battery life. And again, you have advanced features again on top of that. Oh, and you get noise cancelling. So this one's the high-end variant, so you get noise cancelling. And again, 32-hour battery life. It's wireless, so is the H7. The H9 costs $300 or €300. So that's pretty interesting. As I said, there's nothing more to add other than it's just, these are just kind of headsets that Sony is making. But it's interesting how they're not calling it PlayStation gear. They're giving it its own brand, InZone. It's kind of reflecting that gaming now is basically cross-platform. That it's not really, it's not relegated to one particular platform or place. And again, a player like Sony is willing to sort of cash in the trend that is PC gaming. So that's pretty interesting, nonetheless. So again, it's quite fascinating to see the Japanese giant offer essentially gaming gear for a broad range of platforms. They're not, again, specifying that it's only that PlayStation gamers could benefit from this, but also PC gamers can enjoy all this cutting edge technology in a way. So pretty cool if you ask me, in a way. All right, moving on, Xiaomi. So next week on July 4th, the Xiaomi 12S series will be unveiled. And it's basically the absolutely monster high-end, top-notch camera variant of the Xiaomi 12 series, judging by the name, the 12S, because the 12T usually means that it's top-notch quality, and expect the best cameras that Xiaomi brings to the table here, along with, again, a lot of memory and a lot of, and top-notch performance in a way. The Xiaomi 12 is like a regular mainstream flagship, and then the sort of the second variant, so the S and the T variant phones are some of the most maxed out flagships in a way. So they've kind of, obviously they've announced next week that they're going to reveal the 12S, and that's pretty interesting, but more than everything, they've kind of confirmed that they're teaming up with Leica for the lenses on the 12S phones, so that's pretty cool in a way. So that'd be interesting to look at. And looking from the teasers, it looks like they're also aiming for luxurious finishes. So for context, we might be looking at a golden metal frame around the camera, so that's pretty interesting in a way. And apparently the 12S Ultra will basically be the new height of mobile imaging, which is pretty interesting. And speaking of mobile imaging and being advanced, while we're talking about this, most people may not know that Xiaomi 12S Ultra will carry a beefy sensor that I think no one has expected. No one's basically saw coming in a way. And that is that the 12S Ultra will come with a 1-inch camera sensor. This is pretty interesting. Again, announcing on top of we're going to see these phones launch next week. Also, they've announced that the 12S Ultra will be kind of the first phone out there to use Sony's IMX989 sensor, which apparently is a 1-inch sensor, on top of the fact that it will offer better light capture, faster focusing, and improved dynamic range, which is pretty interesting. Apparently, you get 76% increase in light capturing capability compared to the iPhone 13 Pro Max. That's pretty interesting in a way. And on, so basically on the Ultra, you'll get this 1-inch sensor. We don't know the resolution, but again, basically they're optimizing the camera to be top-notch. Apparently, Sony and Xiaomi have essentially worked together on this 1-inch sensor, and it's costed them $15 million to bring this design to the world. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And as I said, Sony has been able to make 1-inch sensors. They've obviously premiered it on their Pro 1 smartphone, if you know that, in a way. So that's pretty cool. On the flip side, the standard 12S phones from Xiaomi will pretty much come standard with a 50-megapixel IMX707 sensor. That'll be a 1x1.28-inch sensor. That's pretty interesting. And you'll basically get a roughly 50% increase in light capture. Again, they're not really focusing on resolution. They're really tweaking the camera quality in other departments, so as dynamic range and, as I said, light capture, which is again critical. So that's pretty cool to see, and it's cool to see Xiaomi is working on top-notch phones with top-notch cameras. It's always good to see that from Xiaomi. Interestingly enough, they're also claiming to say that the 12S Ultra will be equipped with a so-called Summicron lens coating that will give it a reflectivity of 0.2% and a light transmittance of 93% while reducing purple fringing and glare. So again, they are really tweaking a lot of things, and as I said, expect these to be some of the best cameras you'll probably get on an Android flagship. I don't know about how the quality of the photos will come out of this. We'll have to see, of course, once these phones come out and once people take photo samples with this, then we'd see how good it is. But again, let's see if it's decent. Hopefully, if these phones are going to be really good in a way. But yeah, these are pretty interesting phones, and again, can't wait for next week, and let's see what they bring to the table, hopefully. So again, pretty fascinating nonetheless. Alrighty, so we gotta talk about the Nothing Phone 1. It's been the talk of town in the world of Android phones, amongst Android fanboys generally. This is the phone from OnePlus's former co-founder, Carl Pei. And already Nothing has released wireless earbuds, and now they're releasing their very first phone. And the launch event is basically less than a fortnight away, so that's pretty interesting in a way. But we got a couple of tidbits. Number one, now we know what processor the Nothing Phone 1 will have. It's not the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. It's the Snapdragon 778G Plus. That's pretty interesting in a way. And then second, apparently, and this is a leak from a particular source, not trust me, bro, okay? But again, an interesting leak, and that is that the Nothing Phone 1 will start at around $400, so that'll be about 31,000 Indian rupees, kind of, because that was leaked in India. That's pretty interesting. That's quite competitive, nonetheless. And then third is we got, thanks to now WinFuture, we got a leak of the phone in black. Now, they showed it in white, but they've showed it in black, which is pretty interesting in a way. So, I mean, dang, they're seriously wanting to compete in that market and that price range. So, again, pretty interesting piece of information. Just forget about the noise upstairs. It's some little small children playing. It's quite erratic in a way. Yes, it's still going on. It's kind of annoying. All right, anyways, so first, we got to talk about the first bit of news, and that is that instead of the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1, the Nothing Phone 1 will feature the mid-range, slightly on the higher end of the mid-range spectrum, Snapdragon 778G Plus as the processor instead of the 8 Gen 1. Now, it's a surprise that they decided to go for the 8 Gen 1 instead of something like, they've went for the, for a mid-range chip, basically the 778G instead of the 8 Gen 1, in a way. But apparently, Carl Pei obviously said this in a article, obviously in an interview to Input Magazine, and that is, the reasons really for picking the 778G Plus was primarily to do with kind of performance, power consumption, and just generally cost. Apparently, This chip was quite suitable from a power saving and heating point of view. It seems like they're designing these devices not just to have sheer raw horsepower, but really to be to have well-crafted experiences and again, well-crafted design. Whatever you make of that back glyph interface, if you know what I mean. Not surprising, kind of. Again, partly surprising, but again, not that much surprising in a way. But weirdly enough, according to Carl, their feature, again, this is what he said pretty much. These are features, for example, he kind of mentioned, he basically said that Qualcomm sort of managed to sort of offer wireless charging and reverse wireless charging to the mid-range chip, even though that doesn't work on the, it's not supported on the 778G Plus, but you get wireless charging and the reverse functionality, which is pretty cool. You don't get it on, again, on the mid-range chips, so probably for nothing, so that's pretty cool in a way. Interestingly enough, the chip in question could support both millimeter wave and sub-6 5G, but it's not going to be released in the US, surprisingly. Shocker, shocker, in case you forgot. The Nothing Phone 1 won't get an American release, but I'm sure it's to do with complications in arranging for carrier support and all. They're probably sure that if they can drum up enough hype down the road, they'll probably release it in the US in a way. But again, for starters, the 778G Plus is a 6-nanometer chip. It has 4 Cortex A78 cores and 4 Cortex A55 cores, along with an X53 5G modem and a Adreno 642L GPU. So you're not getting a slow, you're not getting a snail here. You're not getting a slug here. You're getting a decently fast and sufficiently good processor that'll be good for the vast majority of people out there. And again, serve the vast majority of people. I mean, if you're not video editing, if you're not like editing 4K edits or probably be playing games at full resolution, you'll probably happily use this phone. And as I said, you're able to get by, and again, you're able to do everything without any hitches or interruptions. I'm probably sure that they decided to go with a mid-range chip because it would have been a lot of work to sort of adapt the 8 Gen 1 over on to make it efficient and fast and to basically squeeze every single ounce of it out of that processor. So it's again surprising in a way, but as I said, it'll be all right, kind of. I don't think there's nothing to be worried in a way. But now we kind of get an idea, sort of, this phone will essentially be a mid-ranger in a way, and that leads us to the price of the phone. We now know more about the pricing because that got leaked, apparently. So we have a leak of the prices, and now what we know is the Nothing Phone 1 will cost around $400 to $450. 400 starting, basically more than $400 roughly for the base spec. That'll go all the way up to $450 for the maxed out spec, 12 gigabytes of RAM and 256 gigabytes of storage. Now, what I'm suspecting is the pricing of this phone is a mid-ranger, but it's putting it fair and squarely with Google Pixel phones and probably the OnePlus Nords and also the Samsung A series phones, the A73 and all those other phones at that kind of price of around $400 to $500. Pretty interesting. Now, obviously, the pricing that has been mentioned here is for the Indian market, and usually phones do start a slightly lower price in India to cater to a vast majority, to cater to a big consumer market over there. Because of the phones, obviously much more expensive over there, no one's gonna buy it. Around 30,000 Indian rupees. It could be competitive in a way, potentially. Who knows? So that's pretty interesting in a way. But more than everything, VinFuture, on the other hand, leaked, basically shared a bunch of photos of the phone in black. Now, we've seen the phone in white, as I said, in pearl white. In its white colorway, and it's pretty interesting in a way, but we've never seen it in black. And oh boy, it looks stunning. It does look stunning, not gonna lie. It looks nice. It kind of it stands out, kind of. It's not weird looking. It's cool. It's good to see that Future. Sorry, it's good to see that Nothing is making. Is planning to have released the phone one in other colorways other than white. I mean, it's pretty cool in a way, But one thing I will say, this is going to definitely compete with the Google Pixel in terms of the audience, in terms of the features, in terms of the sort of experience over raw horsepower. Again, pretty interesting set of really interesting developments here, nonetheless. Again, quite fascinating, nonetheless. Right, before we move to some Apple news, we're going to talk about a smartwatch in particular, and that is... the Montblanc. Is that how you pronounce it? Montblanc would probably be the way to say it, but the proper way to say it would be Montblanc Summit 3. Sorry if I butchered the pronunciation of that. The Montblanc Summit 3. So basically we call it the Summit 3 here. So we have a new smartwatch kind of, and it's made by, it's obviously by the famous luxury brand, obviously. And it's the first smartwatch in a way to run on Wear OS 3 by Google. But not just that, apparently it'll be compatible with iOS. Now this is not really big news in a way, but if you ever used one of those Samsung Tizen watches, or if you used one of the Android Wear watches or one of the Wear OS watches, you will probably know very, very well that you cannot connect it to your iPhone because it doesn't have that deep integration with iOS like it is with Apple Watch. It's quite jarring, and that's probably why Wear OS watches haven't fared very well in a way. So that's pretty interesting in a way. But yeah, obviously Wear OS 3 by Google is coming, and the Pixel Watch and the Galaxy Watch 4 will support it, obviously, but that only works with Android devices straight off the bat. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And apparently the way it will work, how iOS support will work, is that there'll sort of be an app, and essentially that'll tie a lot of things from the iPhone over to the smartwatch. So that's pretty interesting in a way. Apparently support will be vary from platform to platform, so not everything will be supported on iOS, but it's good to know that it'll probably work and you'll be able to do some things with it in a way. Now you're probably wondering about the price of this watch. It's a nice looking Montblanc watch, and it being a smartwatch in a way. This will cost around 1,250 euros, or about $1,300. Now, at this point, you might as well get an Apple Watch if you're into iPhones. That is, so I don't know about you, but it's a nice watch. It'd probably do what it says on the tin, and that is tell the time and basically track your steps and let you play YouTube music in a way. But honestly, at this point, if you're spending that kind of money, you might as well get a proper smartwatch, like a Pixel Watch or Apple Watch. But the thing about the Pixel Watch is you cannot obviously connect it to, it doesn't work with iOS, so that's pretty interesting in a way. But again, it's good to see that there are Wear OS watches that you can buy that will support your iPhone, so that's pretty cool in a way. And while we're already talking about Apple, Ming-Chi Kuo, iconic analyst, a legend, let's just say, in the world of Apple rumors and basically anything to do with Apple's devices, tweeted out a bit of information, kind of. Apparently, he did in his latest, essentially, supply side surveys. Obviously, talks to suppliers of Apple components for iPhones and all. Now, he wrote on Twitter, and I'll quote his tweets here, and quote, "My latest survey indicates that Apple's own iPhone 5G modem chip development may have failed, so Qualcomm will remain exclusive supplier for 5G chips of second half 2023 new iPhones with 100% supply share versus the company's previous estimate of 20%. Basically, what he's trying to say is that Qualcomm completely supply 5G chips to the iPhone instead of, say, supplying only 20% as it was planned or expected. Moving on, here, Qualcomm's revenue and earnings per share in second half 23 and first half 24 will likely beat market consensus thanks to its sole supplier position for 5G chips of second half 23 new iPhones as Apple fails to replace Qualcomm." And then he goes on to say that, quote, "I believe Apple will continue to develop its own 5G chips, but by the time Apple succeeds and can replace Qualcomm, Qualcomm's other new businesses should have grown enough to significantly offset the negative impacts caused by the order loss of iPhone 5G chips." That's pretty interesting. So he basically claims that Apple's, now most may know this, obviously, Apple's been making its own processors. It's been making its own desktop chips, its own phone chips for a long time, of course, since the first iPhone. And now, obviously, Apple's looking to make its very own cellular chip, because obviously then it'll give it much more control and give it more optimized experience in a way. But apparently, it's not been working for Apple, which is strange. But then again, it might be surprising, given that, as I said, Apple has transitioned all its Macs to Apple Silicon, but I think cellular chips are a completely different beast, you could say, compared to, let's just say, full-on SoCs, kind of. So it's not surprising to hear what he's saying here, but basically his point is that next year's iPhones will essentially still have Qualcomm chips, and probably the year after that we'll still see Qualcomm chips in the iPhone. So that's pretty interesting in a way. Again, didn't expect this to happen, but he has a good point, kind of, in a way. But then again, given this is Min Chee Ko, he obviously probably has nearly laser, you could say, nearly perfect kind of predictions with Apple, where Apple is at, especially with supply of components, and especially with kind of these kind of internal development. I'd probably assume that it's going to be a whole while before we see a 5G chip on the iPhone that's made by Apple on an iPhone eventually. But when that happens, as I said, it'll be a few years' time, sort of. So there's nothing useful to add here, but then again, it could be a while, let's just say that. It's just one of those things that'll take a couple of more years to perfect, potentially. I probably assume that they might have already got a kind of a low-key sort of a kind of eyeballing, so you could say a rough chip design, but I'm sure it's not like ready to be put on an iPhone. It might be having issues, because I still remember that there was like a issue with iPhones several years ago where processors made by Samsung kind of lagged pretty much, and then ones made by TSMC performed faster, and there was a disparity basically. So it's not that straightforward to kind of make your own processors. There are a lot of issues, and as I said, there probably is a lot of prototyping and work behind the scenes that we don't get to see. But yeah, it'll be a while probably, in a way. Moving on, Mark Gurman from Bloomberg obviously wrote in his recent newsletter, and he basically claims that Apple is looking to make new Macs and new devices. So according to him, basically, I'll quote him here, Apple is looking to create more M2 Macs, including a new Mac Mini, 14 and 16-inch MacBook Pros with M2 Pro and Max chips, just like the M1 Pro and Max from last year, and a Mac Pro with an M2 and M2 Extreme. That's pretty interesting. We've had the Pro and Max, but not and the Ultra, but not an Extreme. So that's an interesting name, in a way. And on top of that, Apple is also developing the M3 chips, and I'm sure they probably are, because it's a very long roadmap, and they probably have breakthrough innovations in the pipeline. But basically, the M3 Max will include the first M3 Max will pretty much be a 13-inch MacBook Air, a new 15-inch MacBook Air, an iMac, a new iMac, and probably a 12-inch Mac, probably a 12-inch MacBook. You don't know. Maybe it says it's an early development, so that's pretty interesting nonetheless. On top of that, he also goes on to claim that we'll see an Apple Watch Series 8 that'll come with the Apple S8 chip, and it could be used in the next Apple Watch SE. Along with that, he's obviously quoted saying the new Apple TV, codenamed J255, is in development with an A14 chip, an additional gigabyte of RAM, and that compares to the A12 chip announced as part of the 2021 Apple TV last year, and could be useful for additional gaming capabilities rolling out in tvOS 16. That includes the Metal 3.0 and all that kind of stuff. So that's pretty interesting. Along with that, the HomePod, codenamed, and again, he goes on to say it, the HomePod, codenamed B620, will run the same S8 chip coming to the watches, the Apple Watch Series 8, and will be closer to the original HomePod in terms of size and audio performance rather than a new HomePod Mini. The new HomePod will have an updated display on top, and there's even been some talk of multi-touch functionality. Oh boy, this is going to be fun. This is going to be fun to have a new HomePod, and it has multi-touch, which will be very useful for user interaction and touch, which is kind of important in a way. Along with that, expect to see a AR and VR headset with an M2 chip and 16 gigabytes of RAM. In fact, even Tim Cook kind of teased it in a recent interview with a Chinese newspaper and going like, yeah, do stick around and watch the space. We have exciting developments. So looks like Apple is going to release an AR and VR headset in a way next year, or probably the year after next year. And again, we expect to see M2 Mac iPad Airs, M2 iPad Pros, and as I said, a low-end iPad with an A14 chip. So that's a lot of new Apple devices coming pretty soon. So if you're in the market for some of these gear, you might want to wait till kind of next year probably. But a new Apple TV or HomePod, this is going to be fun. It'll be a touch bit faster, and it'll probably support more future versions of Apple software, which is kind of important in a way. I mean, so that's pretty interesting, if you ask me. It's cool to see Apple is looking to sort of bring on sort of multiple new devices, and obviously a new segment with this AR and VR headsets. So again, pretty interesting development. Again, pretty interesting scoop from Gurman himself, nonetheless. Alrighty, finally, EVs. So obviously we tend to talk about other things like smartphones and obviously gaming and all, but also touch on electric vehicles because they're the hot new vehicle sort of. They're in the hot new vehicle segment. They're trending. It's everywhere. It's going to obviously dominate the world of cars. And today we have an interesting new EV that you definitely want to check out. So Hyundai has obviously been making electric and hybrid vehicles for a long, long time. They've made the Ioniq. And then obviously last year they released the Ioniq 5, the iconic crossover in a way. The Ioniq 5, get it? See how it rhymes? And now they're showing off a new EV that they're going to launch next year, hopefully, the Ioniq 6. Now, this one was long time coming because Hyundai basically announced it, sort of. They had the Prophecy concept, if you remember that. It basically was a smooth kind of, it was like a smooth saloon, a smooth luxury sporty saloon concept based on Hyundai's earlier coupes of the early 2000s, and it was all electric, it was fast, it was supposed to take on the Taycan and the Model S from Tesla, and now obviously this is the production model, the Ioniq 6. It emphasizes an idea of emotional efficiency. Basically this looks like a Taycan or one of those sleek sporty saloons, kind of, if you ever had one, or the Mercedes GLS. This is what I've seen online. People have said it looks like a Mercedes GLS to an extent. And there's more noise upstairs. That's pretty interesting. Anyways, the Ioniq 6 has the idea of emotional efficiency, which apparently is this unique aerodynamically sculpted silhouette that gives you simple yet sensuous curves. This is typical PR speak, obviously. But basically, it's aerodynamic. It has this aggressive kind of sloping curve, meaning there's a lot of room, kind of, and it kind of looks to the naked eye like a Korean EQS. If you've seen the Mercedes EQS, and just imagine if Hyundai designed the EQS, you would have this. Speaking of that, everyone knows that the EQS has one of the lowest drag coefficients of any production car right now, but Hyundai beats them to the punch. The Ioniq 6 will feature a ultra-low drag coefficient of just 0.21. Apparently, because you have a low noise already and active air flaps at the front, wheel gap reducers, and again, optional digital side mirrors. Did I say it side? Anyways, digital side mirrors. Basically, they kind of look like transparent. Like little transparent, what do you call them? You call it basically like transparent mirrors, but they don't have a mirror. They have cameras behind, so you could see it on the side. Obviously, optional in the sense that depending on the market and regulations, they actually would stick an actual side mirror, because obviously you cannot put a camera where there's a side mirror, even though it would help in the aerodynamics. So you basically get a boat tail structure in a way. And it's very aerodynamic in a way. Again, taking on the likes of Mercedes with the EQS and the EQE, which has that particular fat, sort of curvy kind of aerodynamic design in a way. On the rear, you have a parametric pixel high-mounted stop lamp. Basically, it has that backlight on the rear. It has this kind of light design that is on the IONIQ 5. So again, it is uniquely a Hyundai IONIQ car. But as I said, it has those pixels at the back along with that upper sort of lamp that is pretty interesting. It's a unique design. It's quite futuristic. And, it's a unique design, kind of, and again, it has the newly designed edge badge on the front and the rear, so that's pretty interesting in a way. On the inside, though, is something else. It kind of has it's inspired by the prophecy concept. It's a bit more realistic, so you have a kind of a cocoon design, sort of, which is interesting. Now, one tidbit that they have said is that the IONIQ 6 will be based on the EGMP that Hyundai has designed for both Hyundai and Kia cars. So basically, just imagine the IONIQ 5's specs and battery and motors and move it to the IONIQ 6 and you basically have this very nice sedan in a way. So that's pretty interesting in a way. But in terms of interiors, you have dual color ambient lighting. So you're able to choose from 64 different colors and 6 different dual color schemes, so that's pretty interesting. Instead of the Hyundai logo on the steering wheel, you have a 4-dot pixel light. It's basically 4-dot indicators that will tell you the battery life, that tell you the battery capacity, so that's pretty interesting in a way. You have the same dual 12-inch displays that you get on the IONIQ 5 also on the IONIQ 6. Pretty cool. But it's more aesthetically pleasing compared to the IONIQ 5, where it's like a aggressive white background, so it's a bit hideous and cheap. Here it's a bit fancier with a black finish kind of between the two displays, so that's pretty interesting. And because it's on the EGMP platform, you essentially have flat floor completely, so that's pretty cool, and you get pretty spacious interiors in a way. But I seen a video and one of the reviewers made an initial impression that the back is a little bit limited because it slopes aggressively for that aerodynamics. So that's something to keep in mind if you're a very tall person. If you're obviously a tiny person, you won't have any issues kind of. So that's something to keep in mind. Interestingly, we're talking about sustainability being a battery electric vehicle. The IONIQ 6's interiors feature sustainable materials, including eco-processed leather for seating, recycled PET fabrics for the seats, bioplant derived from vegetable oils for the doors, that's interesting, and bio-PET fabric for the headliners, so that's pretty interesting, and bio-TPO skin for the dashboard. Apparently, get this, recycled fishing nets for your carpeting underneath on the floor instead of regular car mats. So your mats are essentially made from fishing nets. Pretty cool. Apparently the first for the IONIQ brand. So that's pretty interesting in a way. So it's pretty cool in a way. So the design is very, the design is stark. It's aggressive. It's sporty. It's supposed to turn heads kind of. It's contentious. Let's just say that. That was someone saying it in one video. It's contentious, kind of. It's supposed to sort of turn heads and really be aggressive, kind of, and unique, and sort of stand out from the long line of electric vehicles that are coming out in the market, in a way. Basically, as I said, this car essentially is what Hyundai describes as an electrified streamliner. So that's fair, and Hyundai has had a nick for making quite slopey vehicles, kind of. You could see it with the Elantra and the other sedans. So Hyundai knows what they're doing here. And apparently, as I said, it's an emotional convergence of functionality with aesthetics. So what we have here is that they've sort of shown off the ins and outs of the car and how it looks. The looks can be deceiving. But what we don't know is the performance, the battery life of this vehicle. And turns out we'll have to wait for it, of course. Obviously, one clue is that it's based on the EGMP. So, obviously, think of the IONIQ 5s as, like, you know, battery range and performance. And kind of move it over to the IONIQ 6. And because it's a sedan, it'll sort of be more grounded. Sort of, it'll be fast. It'll probably be a tad bit faster than the IONIQ 5. It won't be on stilts, kind of, if you think about it in a way. On top of that, interesting enough, on the you won't have the buttons to sort of bring your window, the electronic controls for your windows is not on the doors, it's actually on the dashboard, sort of on the driver's side. So right where you have the drive mode shifters, you'd have the buttons to sort of control your windows. So that's pretty interesting. So that'll be a little getting used to. On top of that, you have transparent accents on a crash bag garnish, a door map pockets, which is pretty interesting, and again, a lower cover essentially on the console, so that give you a spaciousness. So that's pretty cool. Essentially, it has that kind of it's supposed to be spacious in a way. So that's pretty interesting, and I definitely can dig what Hyundai is going for here. They essentially want to create a sustainable, futuristic sedan. It's sporty, it's fast, it takes on the European sedans that you have that are very good and electric. And also, Hyundai is getting a fairly good market share from its IONIQ 5 EVs, so pretty cool. As I said, if you really want to know about the performance and the range, you'll have to wait till later this month when Hyundai apparently will be doing a world premiere of this car and basically show the full specifications. What we've seen here is the looks, kind of, and as I said, looks can be partly deceiving. But it looks nice, not gonna lie. It looks really nice, and I kind of dig it. It's quite contentious, as I mentioned earlier, but it looks cool. I kind of dig it. It's unique. It's unlike anything on the market, kind of. And it's really cool. It's kind of competing with the Mercedes and the Polestars of the world and the Teslas. It's unique, and I think it's pretty cool. You gotta stand out sometimes if you want to sell electric vehicles, because sometimes you're probably making the same sorts of vehicles, the same sorts of offerings, and you gotta stand out, sort of. And when you stand out, you definitely can take out market share from Tesla and from Mr. Musk in a way. So again, pretty fascinating, not gonna lie. It's pretty fascinating nonetheless. I kind of dig it, not gonna lie. It's pretty cool nonetheless. Right, this leads us to the end of the episode. What do you think? Let me know. There's the email in the show notes. There's my social handles. You can definitely check that. But as I say, if you want to send any thoughts, or again, if you have anything to say, let me know. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Zaid underscore my 199. Show me a message or a tweet if you can. Subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss another episode. And yeah, till next week, this is your boy Mom signing out. Wherever you are, whatever you're up to, have a wonderful day. All right. And again, I'll see you with another episode of Mom's Got to Talk. All right. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for listening. Ciao.